I'd like now to welcome Allison Gopnik. She is professor of psychology at the University of California at Berkeley. Her most recent book is The Philosophical Baby: What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
So nice to be here.
So you have written, which I find absolutely fascinating, that since Plato, Western philosophers have actually not really observed children, even while making lots of statements about them. How can this be?
Well, the truth is you could read 2,000 years of philosophy and basically think that people reproduce by asexual cloning. Philosophers didn't pay very much attention at all to children. The 1967 Encyclopedia of Philosophy had 4 references to children, many fewer than to angels, for example. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. A sort of obvious reason is that for most of that time, the philosophers and for that matter, most of the psychologists and psychiatrists were men who weren't paying very much attention to babies and children. And children were seen as being sort of part of women's world and not really worth paying too much attention to. Now, there were people who did look at children, but when they looked at children, what they usually saw were sort of defective grown-ups. People said that children were irrational and illogical and that they couldn't understand cause and effect. They couldn't take the perspective of others. They were egocentric. They were amoral. And none of those things turn out to be true.
Were there parallels to what people said about women?
Well, I think it's probably fair to say that there was a kind of great chain of being picture of humanity, which was that basically whoever was writing the book was at the top of the chain. And then everybody else, children, women, quote-unquote primitive peoples, were somehow not quite at that high level. So the picture was that there was this kind of ideal, rational human being who often sounded an awful lot like the male philosopher who was writing the book.
Exactly.
And then there were all these other kind of intuitive or emotional, but not really rational and thoughtful creatures out there. And children tended to be put in that category, sometimes positively, as by the romantic philosophers and poets, often negatively, and often just not paid much attention to at all, often just sort of ignored, even though, after all, for most people most of the time, children and their relationships to them are among the most important things in our lives, the places where we feel the most profound emotions, where we have to face the most profound moral dilemmas. And yet, children didn't really play a role for all those years in philosophy. Now, that's a kind of cultural and social reason. And I think one thing that happened was that in the 1970s, as more and more women became psychologists and as more and more men started having babies, there was less of a divide between the people who knew and appreciated and understood babies, who were mostly people who were taking care of them, and other people. But I think there's something else that happened, which is that for all of those years, it would have been pretty hard to figure out what babies and children were thinking. And I think part of the reason why people had such a low opinion of babies and children was that if you try to ask them questions in our adult language, they don't look very smart. So if you ask a 10-month-old what he thinks about things, you're not going to hear anything very intelligent. And even if you ask a 3-year-old what he thinks, you're likely to get a beautiful monologue about ponies and birthdays and sort of strange stream of consciousness poetry. But you're not likely to get anything that sounds very rational. So I think that was also part of the reason why people underestimated children for all those years.
And then Piaget and Vygotsky, the psychologists, came along in the early 20th century and really started to observe children, which you write about really beautifully. And that was groundbreaking. What did they, they actually started looking. Piaget wrote about his own children. What did they see and how did it change things?
Well, the really striking phenomenon was that when you looked at children, it actually turned out that they were much more complicated and much more interesting than anybody had thought. And Piaget did, it should be said, Piaget, and we should really say the Piagets, because it turns out that it was actually Piaget's wife who did a lot of the observation of the children. But Piaget did wonderful work showing just how complicated and interesting and strange even the actions and thoughts of very young children were. But understandably, given that he was the first person doing this, and given that the tools he had were just basically looking at children and taking notes about them, he still drastically underestimated what babies and children could do. So he still thought of them as being very limited to the here and now, to their immediate perceptions, not being able to think abstractly or to take the perspective of other people until they were relatively old, until they were well into the school age years. And the big revolution in the past 30 years or so has been discovering that literally even the very youngest babies already both know more and learn more than we ever would have thought possible. And I think the technological shift that was really responsible for this was that we started having film and videotape. And what that meant was that we could actually look at what children did and even what very young babies did, and we could do it in an objective way. So I think for all of those thousands of years, mothers and caregivers and other people who were taking care of babies had thought to themselves, gee, it looks as if he recognizes me, or, you know, I could swear that he was trying to figure that out. But it was very hard to establish that scientifically until you had something like a videotape where you could give a baby a problem, see what the baby did, and then repeat that over and over again in an objective way.
I would guess that some of the stuff that has come out of that scientific observation is stuff that observant mothers sort of have known all along.
Well, I think what, you know, whenever you write about psychology, you come up against the sort of what people sometimes call the grandmother problem, which is that people say, oh, yeah, that's obvious. But it's worth saying that for all those years when people were saying that babies were limited to the here and now and couldn't tell the difference between fantasy and reality and couldn't think causally, everyone said, oh, yeah, that's obvious, too. I think that parents and other observers certainly have had the sense that in general, there was more going on, that children knew more, appreciated more, thought more than appeared on the surface. But look, even for me as a developmental psychologist, I'd say every month some new result comes out and I say, oh, come on, they couldn't do that. I mean, in my lab, it's kind of a joke. My graduate students, optimistic graduate students, are always coming in and saying, well, let's try and see if the three-year-olds can do this. And I say, oh, come on, the three-year-olds won't be able to do this. Maybe we'll try it with the five-year-olds. And they say, no, let's try it with the three-year-olds. And the three-year-olds can do it, and then the two-year-olds can do it, and then the 15-month-olds can do it.
Now, what's an example of that?
Well, let me give you an example of something that we're working on right now, which is whether children can understand some abstract logical principles like same versus different. So can they make an abstract principle that say if two red things are the same and two green things are the same and two blue things are the same, that those are all the same sort of principle of sameness? And until recently, we thought that children really had a hard time appreciating that kind of second level of abstraction. And in some studies that we're doing in my lab right now, it looks as if even maybe even 15-month-olds can appreciate that if you ask them the question in the right way. One of the things that was most surprising to me was that babies seem to understand a lot about probability and statistics, because that's something that even adults have an incredibly hard time understanding. And I don't think that until we actually started doing the studies, I would have at all predicted that babies as young as 7 months, for example, seem to understand some basic statistical principles about when you can predict that when a particular outcome is more likely or less likely than another outcome. That felt like something that they really shouldn't be able to do.
And what does that look like?
Well, let me give you an example of a beautiful experiment, not actually done in my lab, but by my colleague, Fei Xu. And what she did was she showed very young babies, 9-month-old babies, a box full of ping pong balls, 80% red ping pong balls, 20% white ping pong balls in one condition, or else the other way around, 80% white and 20% red. And then she showed the babies an experimenter taking some ping pong balls out of that box and putting them in another container. And sometimes the thing that the experimenter picked out had the same probability as the box. So sometimes what she'd do, say, is it was 80% red, 20% white, she'd pick out 4 red and 1 white ball. But sometimes she reversed it. So it would be 80% red, 20% white in the box, and she would pick out 1 red and 4 white balls. Now, both of those sequences of events are possible. So it's perfectly possible to pick out 1 red and 4 white balls from a mostly red box. But that's a much less likely event than picking out 4 red and 1 white. So if you think about it as if you were a scientist, if you saw that sequence of events, you should say to yourself, gee, there's less than 0.05 probability that this happened by chance. It's very unlikely that this was this happened by chance. And in fact, what she discovered was that the babies looked much longer at the unlikely event than they did at the likely event. And that fits with a whole lot of other studies that show that babies tend to look at things that are surprising and interesting and they're going to learn from. So the babies already seem to be recognizing that one event was less likely than another, and when it was less likely, then they wanted to explore it more and find out about it more.
We're talking to Professor of Psychology Allison Gopnik. So babies and children are remarkably rational, and you call them little scientists. And we don't, I mean, it's sort of counterintuitive for a lot of people who think that children are irrational and rationality is something that we learn and not everybody learns it. And so what's another example of what that looks like for little kids?
Well, one of the things that we have been doing in my lab is looking at how children do causal inference. So how do they work out what kinds of things make what other things happen out there in the world? Now, if you ask adult scientists, for example, you can make a pretty good argument that that's what science does more than anything else. We look at patterns of evidence, we look at statistics, and we work out how the world works on that basis. But for adults, it's very hard to do that consciously and explicitly. So if you ask people to make judgments about probabilities or what their consequences are, they famously make all sorts of mistakes. What we did with the children was instead of asking them to do things like calculate probabilities, we just gave them a little machine that we call the Blicket detector. And the Blicket detector is a little box that lights up and plays music when you put some things on it, but not other things. And what we did was we showed the children patterns of events about how that box worked. So, for example, we'd show them something like this. Red block goes on the box lights up. Blue block goes on the box, nothing happens. Now the red and the blue block together go on the box, and the box lights up, and that happens 3 times. And now we just ask the children to make the box go. Now, if you think about it, they've seen both the red and the blue block associated with the box lighting up. But if they were like scientists, they should think to themselves, the red block makes the machine go just by itself. So it's the blue block is just extraneous. It's just there, but it doesn't really have the causal power. They'd be doing the equivalent of what scientists do when they partial out the effects of the other block, the sort of thing we do in statistics. And that's exactly what the children did. So the children, even though they'd seen the blue block associated with the machine, they didn't use that to make their inference. They made a much more clever inference. They looked at the whole pattern of evidence, all the data, and then they could work out which parts actually showed you the cause and which ones didn't. If you think about it, it's kind of like something like trying to analyze whether cigarettes cause smoking, where cigarettes could be correlated with lots of other things. It could be that people who smoke cigarettes a lot are more overweight, and you have to partial out, you have to figure out which one of those potential causes is really the actual cause.
And it turns out the kids are doing that all the time, not just when you give them these problems, but they're doing it in their cribs, they're doing it with their blocks, with their blankets, with everything they come in contact with.
Well, I think one of the nicest things that's come out of these studies is that we started the studies actually showing the children the patterns and seeing what kinds of inferences they drew. But one of the things we've discovered is that children, just like scientists, are also doing experiments a lot, except that when they do experiments, we call it getting into everything. So there's a whole lovely line of research that shows that when children, you just give children, say, our machine and a bunch of blocks and watch what they do, just playing with the machine, they'll do the kinds of things that will give them the most information about how the machine actually works. So just in their everyday playing around, they're actually doing a kind of little experimental research program to figure out how things work.
And when parents understand that, then they can understand what kids are doing and not just tell them, don't do that.
Well, that's the hope anyway. Now, of course, sometimes children do experiments that are dangerous and they need us to protect them.
Fork in the socket.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, one of the things that I've argued is that children may really be designed to do things that are much less likely weirder, stranger than the things that adults do. And that adults are designed to take care of children, keep them alive, during that time when children are doing all that kind of wild, crazy exploration. One of the mysteries that philosophers might have been thinking about for all those years is, why is it that we have children at all? I mean, not the obvious reason, which we all know, but why is it that human beings have such a long period of childhood? Our children are immature and dependent on us for much longer than the children of any other species. And we have to put an enormous amount of work and energy into just keeping them alive. And one argument is that that early period, that early protected period, gives children a chance to try experiments that they might not be able to do if they were just preoccupied with getting through the day and making things happen and doing all the things we do as adults.
And that gives us an evolutionary advantage?
Exactly. Our great evolutionary advantage is not that we're very good at doing anything in particular. It's that we're very good at learning how to do new things in many different environments. We now think that part of the stimulus for our very rapid evolution as Homo sapiens was the fact that our environment was changing a lot. The environment was getting more variable. Actually, interestingly enough, it seems to have been caused by climate change, although in those days not human-caused climate change. And we can survive and thrive in a much wider range of different kinds of places and times and environments than most other creatures. And we think that that's because we can learn. We can look around us, figure out, here's how this place works, and figure out what to do to actually thrive in that particular place. Now, that's a great strategy, but it has one big disadvantage, which is that until you go through that process of learning, you're going to be helpless. So you don't want to have the mastodon charging at you and be saying to yourself, what should I do? Maybe a slingshot would work here, or a spear. You want to have actually solved that problem before you actually have to face the problems of adulthood. And evolution seems to have given us this kind of division of labor, where we have this early protected period where we can just explore alternatives, learn about the world, without having to worry very much about feeding ourselves or taking care of ourselves, because we have devoted nurturers and caregivers who will do that. And then as adults, we can take those things that we learned as children and actually put them to use to solve the problems that we need to do as adults.
Now, adults, of course, during that long, long period of immaturity, are teaching children everything they know to help them solve problems, but children are also coming up with all sorts of things themselves. Did you call them somewhere the children are like the R&D people and the adults kind of implement their ideas?
Exactly. So I think you can think about this division of labor as being, think about children as being the research and development division of the human species. And we adults are production and marketing. So they're the ones who get to just think up all of these blue sky innovations. They get to think of brand new ideas that no one else has ever had before. Now, a lot of those ideas, almost by definition, are going to be really terrible ideas. But every once in a while, there's going to be a good one. And the adults can take advantage of some of that innovation to change what they do and to continue to progress and function in the world.
One also can't help but wondering, while reading your work, whether some of the most creative adults are people who've kind of kept those quote-unquote childlike ways of thinking and exploring, whether they be artists or scientists or whatever.
Yeah, I think one of the questions that people often ask is sort of, well, if the kids are so smart, why are we so dumb or limited? And is there something we can do to be more like the children? Now, it's worth pointing out that there are lots of things that we can do, like tying our shoes or crossing the street or getting our clothes on in the morning, that are big advantages that those wild, creative, innovative children are not doing so well. But I think it's still true that even for adults, there's this kind of tension between what computer scientists talk about as a difference between explore learning and exploit learning. So explore learning is when you just try all sorts of new things without worrying very much about whether they're going to work, versus exploit learning, when you are systematically trying to find a solution to a problem that you think will work. And I think even for adults, being able to shift back and forth between those two ways of functioning is really important. And I think it's interesting that if you talk to the people in Silicon Valley near Berkeley, where I am, places like Pixar or Google recognize that to have creative employees, you need to give them a space to play. Now, you can't make things happen if you're just playing all the time. You need somebody at some time to narrow down your options and say, okay, we're just going to do this one experiment, or we're going to just have this story idea and not all those other story ideas. But putting yourself in a kind of childlike situation, being open up to lots of new possibilities, being sort of released from the pressure of actually making decisions is a way that I think even adults can have some of that childlike innovation and creativity.
We're talking to Professor of Psychology Allison Gopnik. One of the things that you write about is that children really imitate very well. And so if they see an adult making an action happen through some very elaborate means, even though it's only one thing that actually has the effect, the children will do all of those actions. Mm-hmm. So they'll turn around 3 times, jump up and down, and press the button. Why are humans so much that way?
Well, I think that's turned out to be a really, really interesting line of research in developmental psychology and comparative psychology now, which is, how is it that we can manage to pass on information from one generation to the next? And again, this seems to be one of our great human advantages. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We can learn things from the other people around us. And literally, even newborn babies already seem to be tuned in to imitate what they see the people around them doing. But there's a kind of interesting paradox, which is, if you just completely imitate what someone else is doing exactly, then you may not ever make progress. Everyone would just do the same things. So what we see in children is that they have this very strong tendency to imitate, including imitating things that don't necessarily make sense to them to begin with. And that is one of the mechanisms for our being able to have culture and transmit things from one generation to another. But it's also true that at the same time, children are modifying or changing or trying out different things when they imitate. So they kind of go back and forth between imitating very exactly what other people are doing and imitating in a more creative and rational way. And the children are actually very sensitive about the context. So for instance, in some of our experiments, if children think that someone is trying to teach them something, then they're likely to imitate them in this very exact, precise way and imitate everything that they're doing, whether it really makes sense to the children or not. Whereas if the children think that the person's just doing this because they're exploring themselves, then the children will also explore. And that means that teaching is a kind of double-edged sword, because it means that, on the one hand, it is a very effective, even preschoolers are very sensitive to whether someone's trying to teach them, and they'll take advantage of that. But it means that teaching children too much means that you can kind of limit the space of things that they're willing to try.
And also, I mean, as you said before, if you give them space, they'll figure out which block it is that actually turns the box on.
Exactly.
And they won't just slavishly imitate.
Exactly. And we did some experiments where what we did was we showed the children, again, a toy that played music. And then we showed them a complicated sequence of events that you could produce to make the toy work. But it turned out that there was actually a simpler solution. You could solve the same problem by only using two of those actions. And if you looked at the statistical pattern of which actions were associated with the toy going off, you could figure out that simpler, more efficient route. And what we discovered was that if the experimenter said, "Huh, here's my toy. I'm just going to try and figure out how this toy works," and then did all the different actions, children figured out the most efficient one, even though they hadn't actually seen the experimenter demonstrate it. But if the experimenter said, "Here's my toy, I'm going to show you how it works," then the children just imitated exactly what the experimenter did. Now, both of those things were rational from the point of view of the children, because they figured, well, look, she knows how it works. She wouldn't have shown me all of these unnecessary bits if they weren't. She wouldn't have shown me all these actions if they weren't really necessary. But it does also indicate that they were in some ways acting less intelligently in that circumstance than they were in the circumstance when they were just exploring.
We're talking to Allison Gopnik, professor of psychology at the University of California at Berkeley and author of the book The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. So it takes people at least 18 years to become adults. Mm-hmm. And that's a long time. And that long time requires love. It requires the loving attention and care and continuity of adults to get through all of these years. What about that makes us specifically human?
Well, I think one of the things that's most striking about us is that we have this enormous caregiving investment. So if you compare us even to our closest primate relatives, not only have mothers, biological mothers taking care of babies, but we have fathers who are involved in taking care of babies. We have grandmothers so humans are unique in that we live past menopause, we live past fertility, and more people think that that's an adaptation to allow grandmothers to help take care of babies. We have other people who aren't even kin who take care of babies. And all of us just kind of take for granted that when we see a baby or a young child, we'll have that reaction of, "Ah, let me take care of this baby." Now, that seems like that's, you know, motherhood. What could be more obvious? But if you think about it, it's actually an amazing relationship. The fact that so many adults are willing to sacrifice so much just to take care of these helpless babies. And I think that particular kind of love that we feel, not only for our own babies, but for babies and children in general, is really striking, really unlike all the other kinds of emotions that we feel. It's hard to think of any emotion that's quite so selfless and altruistic, because we don't really expect to get a return from it, and yet so profound and deep, and also that is an emotion that you can feel towards a baby where you don't even know very much about what that baby is like yet. So I think it's a very profound kind of emotion. And I think that a lot of the even spiritual ideas about what love is like, consciously or unconsciously, are kind of modeled on that particular kind of love that seems to be very much part of this distinctively human demands of this long childhood with lots of nurturance that goes with it.
It seems like that's also connected to teaching, the passing on of culture, mm-hmm. the older people in a dance company teaching the younger people the dance, and so on. I mean, we're all engaged in that, even those who aren't particularly interested in having children, in that activity in some way.
Well, I think that's exactly right. So again, if you think that this cultural transmission, now it's important to say this isn't unique to humans, we see it in other animals, but it certainly is a dimension on that divides us from other animals. So we rely much more on the information that we get from preceding generations. In fact, most of what we know, most of what we do, most of what's around us is the result of this, what some people call the cultural ratchet, the fact that each generation can make discoveries and then pass it on to the next generation. And that caregiving that we just take for granted with children is a very important mechanism for transmitting that kind of information. And one thing that I'm thinking about, especially now, is that actually having this variety of caregivers, the fact that, for instance, we have grandmothers. This may have something to do with the fact that I've just become a grandmother of an 18-month-old. It's not just that those grandmothers are there able to provide nurturance and love and cassava roots. They also can provide information about what happened to them, about their experience, so that a baby can actually get 3 generations worth of knowledge from the time they're born. And what we've discovered in psychology is that literally from the time they're born, babies seem to be tuned in. They seem to have learning mechanisms that are specially designed to let them take advantage of that information that's coming from preceding generations.
And sometimes grandparents know things that parents don't know.
Well, one thing for sure that grandparents know is how to raise children, because they've actually done it. So I think one of the things that is a really unfortunate, though maybe unavoidable, feature of our lives as contemporary parents is that we have a very strange thing that happens, which is that people often don't have children until they're in their 30s or 40s. And very often those people have never taken care of a child themselves before. And even more often, they're raising those children by themselves without anybody else around who's had the experience of raising a child before. And that's very different from the experience of the cultures in which we evolved. So it seems as if in a sense we're designed to know a lot about caregiving because we have experiences of caregiving from very early on, and also because we're surrounded by people who have done caregiving themselves. And I think a lot of the anxiety that seems to come with caregiving nowadays comes from the fact that parents are isolated and haven't had these experiences and don't have other people around them who they can trust who've had those experiences.
And therefore, they're reading books and taking classes about all this stuff.
In fact, I think part of what's happened is that those people having their children later and having them in this isolated way, you know, they haven't had much experience of caregiving, but they've had a lot of experience of working and going to school. So then they approach the task of caregiving as if it's like working and going to school. Okay, if somebody just tells me what the instruction manual says and gives me the, you know, gives me the right study guide, then I'll be able to solve this problem. And caregiving isn't really like that. Caregiving is about a relationship. It's not about a kind of goal-directed process that you can control.
Let's talk for a moment about the capacity to learn. I mean, we know that children have a tremendous capacity to learn and change and, for example, learn languages and things that become much more difficult as adults. To what extent does that capacity to learn and change stay with us as adults? And to what extent does it really go away?
Well, again, the idea, one idea that people have, people, for instance, who are trying to design robots or computers that can learn, is that there's this really sort of inescapable trade-off, which is a trade-off between being flexible, being able to do new things, and being able to do the things that you do really, really well and really effectively and really efficiently. And even if you look at the development of the brain, what you see is that early on, there are many, many, many new connections being formed. Lots of possibilities, lots of plasticity. The young brain can change very, very easily in the light of new experience. But just as a function of getting better and better and better at doing something, just as a function of knowing more and more and more, the things that we're good at doing, we get better and better and better at doing, but they also become harder and harder to change. They become more entrenched and more automatic, and it's harder to switch and do something else. So there's some sense in which the kind of bad news is that it just seems as if the nature of the game is that we can't do both at the same time. We can't be completely flexible and be good at learning and be really effective and be good at actually doing things and planning and acting at the same time. So even as adults, what we seem to have to do is switch back and forth from being in the playful, creative, unconstrained learning mode and then being in the, okay, now I'm going to actually make things act, executive function, prefrontal kind of mode.
You compare it to a map, like babies are like a map of old Paris with lots of millions of little streets and no big thoroughfares, and adults have these boulevards that let traffic move a lot faster, but the little streets don't get used so much.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So that adult brain is really a kind of lean, mean acting machine. It's really good at doing things. It's not so good at changing. And I think in some contexts, adults are obviously better at changing. A good example is when we go to a new place, for example, when we travel to a new country and suddenly everything's new and we have to think about it again. And there's some evidence that even adult brains are more what neuroscientists call plastic, more flexible, better at learning than we would have thought was true in the past. But I think it's still true that even the very best, most innovative adult minds aren't really in the same ballpark as even every two-year-old's mind. Those two-year-old minds are really designed to have that that vast kind of learning capacity.
But as you said, I mean, in our evolutionary history, we adapted to different sets of climate change and very hugely changing conditions, and it was the adults who kind of did the adapting. I mean, they didn't all just die off and leave it to the two-year-olds.
Right. Well, but I think the part of the idea is that the adults could do that because the next generation. So, for example, if you think about technological change, my husband is actually one of the co-founders of Pixar. And at the time that he was inventing things like computer movies, there were only, you know, four guys in the entire world who knew how to do this. It was hard. It took a lot of attention. It took really, really smart people. But once they had discovered it, the next generation, my 18-month-old grandson, you know, has already figured out how to use his iPhone, which is sort of staggering. The next generation could stand on the shoulders of the people who had discovered things with great blood and sweat and tears and could just integrate that into their lives, could learn it from scratch as if it was all just something that you could take for granted. So I think part of what happens is that having this capacity for flexibility means not only that younger people can innovate, but also that they can take advantage of the innovations of the previous generation and basically treat them as if they were second nature.
We're talking to Professor of Psychology Allison Gopnik. What happens when children aren't loved, when they're abused, when they're neglected, when all this caregiving that you've been talking about really doesn't happen?
Yeah, one of the things that we know more and more is that when that kind of caregiving context, those people who support and protect children, when that is undermined, then that flexibility in learning is undermined too. That seems to be true even neurophysiologically. So we know that having high levels of stress early in life affects children's brains in a way that makes it harder for them to be flexible and to be able to learn more. And one of the things that I think we really have to face again in this culture is that many children are deprived of the really basic kind of care and that nurturing context in which they could learn. More than 20% of children in America, for instance, are growing up in poverty. And worse than poverty, they're growing up in isolation. They're growing up without that village of people who are there to nurture and take care of them. And that's a terrible waste. I mean, it's not just sort of wrong, but it's a terrible waste of those children's intellectual potential and learning potential.
I think it's also important. I mean, when people talk about poverty, they use this blanket statement, and there's such a difference between a kind of poverty where a child is alone in a room without much attention and the kind of like a Guatemalan village
exactly.
where there's not a lot of money, but there's people and nurturing and culture and all those kinds of things.
Yeah, I think the issue in America really isn't particularly an issue about how much money you have. It's an issue of how isolated you are and how much social support you have. And in fact, there are studies that show that mothers and children who have a kind of social support network are able to be resilient, to keep going in spite of poverty, for example. The trouble is that in America, poverty is also associated with being isolated, with not actually having that network of people who are there to take care of you. And we don't have any clear system for helping to support parents and children in those early years. In fact, you're more likely to be in poverty between the ages of 0 to 5 than in any other age group. So we actually, you know, it's a wonderful thing that we have a system for providing support for people who are older, but we don't have any equivalent system of support for, say, children between the ages of 0 to 3, even though we know that that's the period when the most and the most profound learning is taking place.
Now, the question of how a person's childhood affects that person's adulthood turns out to be pretty complicated. I mean, there are children, you have this amazing example of the Romanian orphanage where all these totally neglected orphans were raised by adoptive parents once they were taken out of the orphanage. And a lot of them really came out okay, and some of them really didn't.
Yeah, one of the things that people are always worried about and think about is how is what I'm doing right this moment with my child going to lead him to be one way or another when he's 30, let's say. And when you're a developmental psychologist, people are always asking you, well, if I do this now, does that guarantee that my child is going to, you know, go to Harvard, or that my child isn't going to complain about me to a psychiatrist, or whatever the story is. And one of the things about that, our being a creature who is designed to live in variable environments, is that we have a tremendous amount of variability. So our developmental system really seems to be designed to have lots and lots of different kinds of people and lots of different kinds of outcomes. And it's this tremendously complex interactions between genetics, which is already has a lot of variation in it, temperament, which is already very variable. When babies are born, some of them are already shy and some of them are already outgoing and some of them are fearful and some of them are risk-taking. And then if you combine all that with interacting with a bunch of very unpredictable, variable caregivers who are all different from one another, and who react differently depending on what the babies are like, you've got a formula for a tremendous amount of complexity. You've got an unbelievably complex, unpredictable kind of system. And when you look at the relationships to adult life, that's pretty much what you see. So you might see that overall, statistically, for example, growing up in poverty makes you more vulnerable to adverse outcomes as an adult. But there are some kids who go through that early deprivation and come out fine. And then there are other kids who have incredibly nurturing environments and have a great deal of difficulty later on in life. There isn't any kind of simple one-to-one relationship that you could describe. It's a very unpredictable, chaotic kind of system where the things that are regular are only over a lot of people when you're looking at statistics and predictions. But, in a way, would we really want it to be otherwise, right? It wouldn't work if what happened was that we could say, okay, this is the kind of child that I want, and I know here's the instruction book, and it will tell me all these things to do, and then if I do all the right things, then the child will come out the way I want. The wonderful thing about having children, both as an individual caregiver, but also for us as human beings, is that they do these unpredictable, strange things that we couldn't ever have anticipated, that we couldn't have ever put in the instruction booklet. And I think the way that we should think about caregiving is it's that we as caregivers can design an environment, this kind of nurturing, protected space in which all that unpredictability and variability and novelty and strangeness and weirdness, including, awful kinds of weirdness, things we really didn't want to happen. All those flowers can actually bloom. And in fact, I think gardening is a pretty nice metaphor for caregiving. Gardening, one of the things about gardening is it never comes out the way you want. The gardener's always sitting there and making plans about where the pansies are going to be, and it never actually comes out the way you want. But that's what's so wonderful about it. If it came out exactly If each flower came out exactly in the right place at the right time, it would be boring. What the gardener really wants to do is put lots of manure in that dirt and make sure that there's lots of sunshine and water and air and all the things that the flowers need. And then you get to watch them do these amazing, unpredictable, diverse things. And I think that's a good metaphor for what we should be like as parents.
Yes, I mean, so it sounds like you can tell parents, provide the basics and chill out.
Well, certainly for middle class parents, for I think we have a kind of funny paradox now, which is one of the things I say is, if you're worried about your children, then you should probably stop worrying. And if you're not worried about them, then you should probably worry more. The things that we worry about, we have a I've also sometimes thought that we should have a kind of redistribution of worries. So for all that worrying that parents do about, well, should I put them front facing in the stroller or back facing in the stroller, or should I give them this kind of healthy food or that kind of healthy food? If we took all that worrying and then we put it into worrying about those 20% of children in America growing up in poverty, it would be a good distribution of worry. We should be really worried about that. We shouldn't be
Right.
so worried about the front facing and back facing strollers.
One of the things that your book did for me is it kind of, to me, it made an argument for having women at the center of every conversation in philosophy and psychology, because women seem to be a lot more inclined to connect questions of love and morality and empathy and so on with the lived experience of childhood and parenthood and caregiving. And you, and instead of making kind of abstractions about these things, talking about virtue or goodness in the abstract, we talk about them in very relational ways. Let's talk for a moment about morality and the development of morality, which starts with empathy, which, as you say, the smallest children are actually capable of having.
Well, again, the sort of traditional wisdom was that children were amoral, and one of the wonderful things that's come out of the science recently is showing that even 15-month-olds are already altruistic. They'll already do something to try and help someone else. And even newborn babies are already empathic. Even newborn babies already can sense the emotions of someone else, and they even take on those emotions, feel the emotions that someone else is feeling. And by the time children are 2.5 and 3, they can discriminate between something that's just a sort of social convention, like, well, nobody should drop their clothes on the floor, and something that's a real moral principle, like nobody should hit or hurt somebody else. So many of our most fundamental moral ideas, I think, especially, the sort of golden rule that other people's feelings count for as much as ours, and that we should treat other people the way that we treat ourselves. That isn't something that children necessarily seem to have to learn. That seems to be something that's there for them from very, very early on.
It's interesting, though, to me that some children, they will see, for example, racism and know that it's wrong and rebel against it, and other ones will take that on as that's the way the world is and embrace it and as adults defend it.
Well, there's again, this comes back from a scientific perspective to this interesting tension that underlies our ability to have this kind of cultural evolution. So, on the one hand, children do pick up the ideas and the conventions and the norms of the people around them. So they can see that, no, we don't drop our clothes on the cubby, or we use our fork, put our fork on the left and our knife on the right. And it turns out that children are very, very sensitive to those kinds of social conventions from very early on, and that's part of how we can manage to transmit our culture as effectively as we can. So children seem to sort of assume, well, if people around me are acting a particular way, then I'll act that way too. But that's in an interesting kind of tension with this other side of children, which is this very basic empathy, this very basic sense of not wanting people to be hurt and wanting to people to be helped, that seems to be there from the very beginning. And I think there's some really interesting cases in history where, say, the abolition of slavery or gay marriage, I think, is another recent example, where there's a real tension between, okay, this is the way people have always done things, but wait a minute, that's not making people happier, that's actually hurting people. And I think it's interesting that in the gay marriage example, which is one of the most relevant recent ones, you see such a strong generational shift. It's the new generation coming up that says, no, wait a minute, the cultural tradition is one thing, but the welfare and thriving of people actually should override the cultural tradition. So I think those are very good examples of the way that our childhood, this kind of injection of novelty and openness into the culture that comes every time we have a new generation of children, actually allows us to make moral progress as well as making technological progress.
Do you feel like we're making moral progress?
Well, it's as Martin Luther King said, the arc of the universe is long. And I don't know about the universe, but certainly the arc of cultural evolution is long. But it does seem to bend towards progress. We're more inclusive. We recognize rights for more people than we used to. A lot fewer children die than they used to. Sometimes when I worry about the future, I think to myself, you know what? Nobody dies of whooping cough and our children aren't dying before the age of 4. That by itself counts as being progress. All you have to do is just have childhood vaccination, and that already means that things are getting a lot better. But I think what's really important is sometimes, we see trade-offs where things that look as if they're progress from one perspective turn out not to be from another. I think what's really important is that people seem to be designed to have both this impulse towards love, this impulse towards empathy, particularly in face-to-face, close, intimate circumstances, and a sense of law, a sense of principles or things like legal conventions that can take that individual love that we feel in close, intimate situations and actually apply it to large groups of people all at the same time. And that those two things, the kind of idea of love and idea of law, are the things that I think are at the heart of morality and at the heart of our ability to revise our moral ideas in the right direction to actually make moral progress.
Alison Gopnik is professor of psychology at the University of California at Berkeley. Her most recent book is The Philosophical Baby: What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thanks so much for having me.